we'll ponder this maybe another time. But
just
good morning.
Just for the record,
yeah,
my view meter,
yep,
is showing a constant input.
I saw that
even when I'm quiet.
I noticed that, and I am hearing a lot of kind of hissy room tone from somebody. I can't say who it's from.
Probably me. Let me screw with my mic gain here real quick. Test, test, test.
I still hear you.
Yep.
I think you're unchanged.
Test, test, test.
Yep. Sounds fine to me. I'm still.
It's dropped a little bit. I'll leave it alone.
Yeah. It sounds like the kind of noise, background noise, that I've in the past been able to filter out relatively easily. So back in the days when we had a really scratchy background noise from you, Jeb, that was a problem. But
to clean the needle.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
There's a local radio station that does a one of their little daily features is 33 and a third. They do it at like, I guess it's not 3:30. Maybe it is 3:30. But anyway, there's certain
that's going around. One of our stations here a couple of months ago started a vinyl Thursday, and every hour from I think it's 8 to 8,
yeah,
top of the hour, they play an entire album side of something on vinyl.
Well, and that's my question. I mean, I was just wondering whether or not these folks really genuinely are playing it on off of vinyl. You know, I suppose a good radio station probably does have a record player floating around someplace. But
well, turntables are cheap these days.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they kind of figured out the technology some time ago.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it's yet another thing that the engineers have to keep, you know, maintain.
Mm-hmm. Well, this radio station... I don't even remember the call letters, but they made it into a news story in the Eagle. They talked mm-hmm. about how the disc jockey brought an old turntable that he found cleaning out stuff for a yard sale or something, brought it into the station. An engineer used a patch cord to plug it in, and the guy played an album, and everybody went wild. Like, wow, you can hear the scratches and pops.
Yeah, right. Well, that's what got me to thinking about it, was I was wondering, well, if they're really playing it off of vinyl, that means it could conceivably skip, all right? I mean, I haven't heard music skip in 40 years, 50 years. But, you know, technically it could.
You haven't been in my... white BMW when there's a CD player.
Well, there's that. Well,
and some of the early portable compact disc players didn't have anything to cushion bumps and stuff, so they would skip sometimes. But
right, yeah. And then of course they put in the they added software that did a buffer so that it caught the skips and stuff. But
it stopped sounding like max headroom.
But a vinyl record could skip. It could, you know, and that's the other thing is I was listening. It was on my car, and so the sound is not great. But I was listening, trying to see, you know, does it sound different? I don't know. I mean, I'm not a real music person, and ironically, I'm not that attuned to sound stuff. But I didn't hear a difference. And you know, of course, the serious music people insist that analog sound is way better than digital sound. And
well, over radio, forget it. You can't really tell the difference.
Well, yes and no. I mean, FM radio these days is pretty good. And
it's very digital. Well, it can be very digital. I mean, but it's still an analog transmission. You still have to use an analog receiver to receive FM. And that's where a lot of it breaks down. The frequency response is not nearly as good as mm-hmm. a live CD with decent speakers.
Yeah, yeah. And then ironically, you've got... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that I can play the same material on a turntable and then play it on a CD, and you will notice the difference. I'm not suggesting that the CD is as warm and, I don't know, colorful, maybe.
Yeah.
But it's definitely crisper, and it's definitely, I mean, I can play a CD or even an MP3 for that matter and hear shit I've never heard before.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Deep in the track.
Right.
Literally. So, you know, I don't know.
Two things for your speakers. frequency response and how little wattage it takes to light them up.
Exactly.
The less it takes, the better off you are.
Okay. Ironically, we're doing this podcast because like we have access to incredible sound quality. I mean, our weird microphones aside, I've always, first of all, we always ship this podcast as mono. We never ship a stereo because there's no stereo content here. There's no stereo data.
Right.
And also, I used to actually digitize it at an even lower band rate than, or bandwidth, I don't know, what's the bit rate or frequency or whatever, whatever the numbers are, a lower quality, because it's all spoken word. It doesn't need to be, if it was music, it'd be different, but it's all spoken word. About a couple of years ago, we actually inadvertently increased the sound quality when I changed some of the software that I was using to do post-production, and the defaults were different, and I just left it, But that's why if you look, you'll notice that way back the, an hour, 20-minute podcast episode MP3 file was a certain size, and it almost doubled at a certain point. And that's because the digitization rates changed when I changed software. And I don't know. That's what I did. Anyways, there's a list. It's a weird list. It's somewhat long, but it's got, I don't know, I couldn't find a real through line in it. I kind of organized it in a some sort of fashion.
No worries.
So, there's a load of shout outs, but they're almost all David. So Jeb, you may want to try and steal something.
Please steal at will.
I'll come up with your own. I don't know.
They weren't shout outs when I put them on the list. They gravitated to that.
So. Yeah, and I just not arbitrarily. I mean, I basically look at an item, and if an item is going to be like just basically an announcement, or calling attention to something, then I put it under shout outs. If I don't think that it's going to spawn a discussion, I put it under shout outs. And as you know, though, sometimes shout outs do spawn discussions. That's fine too. All right then. All right, and then
push record.
Push record. Already did. Thank you. So here's travel tips. All right.
We all know time spent flying is not subtracted from your lifespan. Bye bye.
And that's enough talking. Let's go flying.
Hasta la vista, baby.
I get it. Yeah, that was good. That was good. All right. After show. Anybody need a break?
Nope.
Nope.
All right. What did I put here for after show stuff? Where'd it go?
Two things. Robopilot using iPad for approaches.
Yeah. But let me promote or demote or whatever from the main list here. You mentioned this Crosswood technique thing. So I got this idea when we last episode's after show. All right. What did we do? We got to talking about crosswind. Oh, we were talking about experiences landing crosswind. And I wanted to ask you. So in my mind, there's basically, generally speaking, two techniques for doing a crosswind landing.
There's three, but go ahead.
Okay. The two that I'm familiar with are, there may be a better names for them, but we'll call them crab and kick. And then the alternate is wing low slip. All right. Which the crab and kick is that you come down final with the nose of the airplane pointed into the wind, so that you're in a crab coming down final, and then at the last moment as you're about to touch down, you kick the airplane straight, all right, and touch down, all right? The alternate being you come down final with the wing into the wind low, one wing low, and you've got some rudder in to straighten the nose out so that you're lined up with the runway center line, all right? The latter way is the way I typically land in a crosswind, and I was just kind of curious how you guys do it.
Depends on the airplane, depends on the wind.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you give me an example? Why would you do one versus the other?
Well, I tend to use crab and kick on high wing airplanes. I find it easier to manage, but and that's only if I can't keep the airplane coming straight down the center line, wings level and nose pointed to the runway. That's the third technique, or at least I thought.
The third technique is a combination of the two.
Okay. Okay.
But on high wing airplanes, I tend to use crab and kick. On low wing airplanes, I keep the nose straight and the wings level, or I use a wing low slip and then straighten it out at the last second. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
So it's a high wing versus low thing. What about you, Jim?
I don't really have a high wing, low wing thing. It's just a matter of, well, let's put it this way. Typically, I will use the wing low method and with rudder to maintain directional control. You can call that a slip. I just call it crosswind technique.
Yeah, I know. A slip is kind of maybe not exactly the right term for it.
Yeah, there's side slips, forward slips, and all that. Technically, it's a side slip, I believe.
Yeah.
The crab method I've used too. Sometimes I'll switch them up. I'll start mm-hmm. with a crab, you know, just to kind of get a feel as I'm falling down final. Just to kind of get a feel for the wind, and then I'll kick the nose straight and lower the wing. And if I still have rudder authority, I'll continue in that mode. Mm-hmm. If I don't have rudder authority, I'll seriously give consideration to going around. But I'll also maybe, you know, allow the nose of the airplane to swing into the wind a little bit, which helps with directional control. Which is why I say that there's really three, and there's not, you know, it's not a bright line between them. I would suggest that all of us at one point or another have flown both techniques on a final approach.
Yeah.
To me, it's not really a high wing, low wing thing. The trick is, if you want to get into high wing, low wing, I think you need to have that wing, the upwind wing down, or more so. There's gray areas here also, but in a crosswind situation, in a high wing airplane, it's advantageous to have that upwind wing lowered throughout the landing and flare.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as we saw this week with Drago and his pilot, you can get caterwampus really quick.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if y'all saw that video.
I did see it. Yeah. Drake. Yeah. It's Drake Co, I believe. Right?
Draco. Drago.
Draco. Draco. Yeah. Draco is the, and we've talked about Draco on the podcast a couple of different times. Draco.
Oh, that's the big PT6 powered Wilga.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he ground looped it and totaled it the other day. And
there's video of the whole thing.
He was
at Reno.
Yeah. There's video of the actual incident or event or accident, or I'm not sure what the right term is.
Oh, that's an accident.
That's an accident. Substantial damage.
Thank you. And then there's also a video of the pilot talking about it after the fact. He's very, very forthcoming about the whole subject.
I give him great cred for being so forthcoming. A lot of people would not have been.
Yeah, yeah.
And fortunately, it won't affect the insurance settlement.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting point. Why do you say that?
When I had my gear up landing.
Yeah.
Straight up. I was all set to put the gear down. Somebody cut me off in the pattern. I was prepared to go around, trying to figure out whether they were going to go around so we didn't turn an interruption into a midair. And the guy did pull out of the pattern and headed out, and I just continued down to land. I just never got back to that point on the checklist that said, put the wheels down.
Yeah.
And I confessed that fully when I got on the ground and to the insurance adjuster, and it didn't make any difference to the settlement.
Mm, okay.
They still paid off.
Yeah,
because the Strago guy, who I wish I knew his name off the top of my head, we could look it up, but he's posted a couple of videos since the event, videos that he shot within minutes of the accident, and where he says this was all my fault. He says I made a really bad choice here, and I think what he's referring to was going his decision to actually take the runway in some really squirrely winds.
There was a front coming through, and that's not the first time somebody's been bit on the tail cone by a fast moving front.
Yeah,
that wasn't there when they turned onto the runway, and 30 seconds later, they're a victim of it.
So if anybody hasn't seen the video,
The video. Go ahead.
Well, it's just that he started to taxi out. He taxied out on the runway, and then you could just see from the motion of the airplane that the winds were just really, really weird, squirrely, gusty, something.
Oh, it was rocking.
Yeah. And then as he started his takeoff roll, he almost immediately, and the way he described it was that a particularly bad gust, which, by the way, I thought was interesting. He referred to them as wind bumps. I'd never heard that term before. I thought that was an interesting metaphor.
You probably won't hear it again. But.
Well, maybe. Anyways, he said a particularly big wind bump caught the wing and lifted it, and then he was off to the races. Between the airplane kind of going at an angle and turning off the runway, and then he went off the pavement and caught a wingtip and basically rolled it up. It's really almost a miracle that nobody got more badly hurt than they did. As I understand it, there were three souls on board.
Everybody walked away.
Everybody seemed to be fine. They were all three of them were pictured soon afterwards. So.
The irony here is that with that big PT-6 turboprop engine in the front of the Wilga.
I know where you're headed.
And its low takeoff speed he could have turned across the runway. The runway Stead is wide enough that he would have been off the ground if he'd have just turned 45 degrees into the wind and taken off across the runway.
Yeah.
And he talks it would have never
that.
Happened.
He talks about that. And I think he said something along the lines of if he was at his home airport, where the controllers know him very well, he'd request such a thing and they'd give it to him. And he sort of implied that because he was at a visiting airport, and also an airport where the Reno air races are going on currently, he chose to keep it a little bit more conventional.
I was at visiting an airport on a story back when we were still flying the Cherokee, so it's been a while ago. But I flew into the airport, and the winds were changing. And by the time my business was done there, I'd finished the shoot and the interview and all that, and I went to get back in the airplane. And the wind that was now blowing 20s, gusting 30s, 90
Yikes.
Degrees to the runway.
Holy moly. Yeah, go ahead.
And before I walked out there, I got that information from my weather briefing. And I in the FBO, and I called a tower and asked him about using a perpendicular taxiway. And he said, I'm glad you asked about that. If you'd have done that without asking, that would have probably been a bust. But I'm going to say that's approved for the conditions, but let's not make a habit of it. And I took a taxiway and took off from the taxiway.
Yeah.
And didn't get any letters in the mail. No problems.
Now, but say again what aircraft you were in?
In a Cherokee 140.
Really? Okay. And they let you do literally an intersection takeoff.
Well, I was off the ground in about five airplane lengths as hard as it was blowing. And just coming back to the crosswind landing technique, that's the same airplane where when it was bringing it back from its pre-purchase inspection, I was doing the flying. Well, the owner of the airplane was the PIC. He's in the right seat. And I landed in about a 15-mile-an-hour crosswind, 90 degrees to the runway, 1-8 at Augusta Municipal. That's 3-alpha uniform. And kept the wings completely level and the nose pointed straight down the runway all the way to the ground. And when we turned off to taxi back to the ramp, this guy looked at me and said, "I didn't know you could do that." And he'd owned that airplane for five. He and his partner had owned that airplane for 5 or 6 years, and he didn't know he could do a crosswind like that.
Yeah,
I mean the airplane had Boku authority for the conditions, and we were just able to. I looked at the wind sock and said, "Okay, that's cross." And he says, "Maybe we should go to mid-continent." And I said, "Well, let's see where we go." And I just cross-controlled the airplane, had the wings level, had the rudder cranked a little bit in the opposite direction to keep it pointed down the runway, and then just had to remember to get the nose wheel straight when it came down. Piece of cake.
One other thing to keep in mind when you're contemplating crosswind landings is your control effectiveness depends on your airspeed.
Yeah.
And it's not the least bit a bad technique to fly that a little bit faster. than you might normally would in, say, calm winds or something. At least down to the runway, and you get right above the runway, get that upwind wheel planted, and as long as you maintain directional control, then you can decelerate and let everything settle down onto the runway.
Mm-hmm.
I've used some variations on that. If you're flying a twin, conventional twin with an engine on each wing, you can use some differential thrust to keep things straight.
Yeah.
And I've been tempted. I haven't got enough multi-time to really get into that kind of a situation, but I've definitely contemplated that.
Hmm. Okay. The other thing, this RoboPilot thing, I don't know, it's like, that's Terminator, Skynet, I don't know what. You know what this is? They've actually built a big servo that puts its quote unquote hands on the yoke and the rudder pedals. Well,
there was a device, I don't know, it's maybe been 5-10 years ago now, an outfit, Aurora Flight Sciences at Manassas, Virginia, had cooked up some kind of a RoboPilot thing that didn't require any modification to the airframe or the avionics, but acted as an autopilot.
Right.
And this sounds like the same kind of thing.
I think this is what they're going for. Yeah. It looks from the picture like the prototype is a pretty big device that requires removing a seat and installing it. But basically it interfaces with the controls by actually, you know, I don't know, putting its hands, if you will, attaching itself to the yoke and to the rudder pedals and to the throttle. And
as opposed to an autopilot, which feeds all of its commands through one servo or the other.
Right. It has servos somewhere attached in the, I don't know what you want to call it, the control stream or
control
something.
System.
But, yeah. So, you know, so ultimately I think what they're trying to get to here is a device that you would actually mount in the seat of the aircraft, so that you could take and basically an unmodified aircraft and just install one of these things and have it fly the airplane. Which I don't know.
Another one of man's attempts to replace himself in the work life.
Just get a student pilot to go with you.
Yeah. Okay.
There you go.
Yeah. So, anyways, there's that. So, I just wanted yesterday's flight for my flight review. For the first of the three flights, I actually used my iPad during the flight. I had been using my iPad for pre-flight and just kind of playing around, but when I actually got into the airplane, I really didn't want that workload, so I put it aside. I was feeling confident, and so we mounted my iPad and we actually paired it with the ADS-B. So that I could see traffic on my iPad, and it was kind of interesting. The one thing that struck me is I thought I kind of basically knew how to use 4Flight on my iPad, but man, there was a whole bunch of features that suddenly came alive, right, when I was in that flight environment, that flight situation. You know, there was like when we left the first airport, so we flew from Sanford to Skyhaven in Rochester, in New Hampshire. Did some pattern work there. Then we were going to fly from Skyhaven to Biddeford, and sort of as we're climbing out of Skyhaven, he says, "Okay," he says, "show me how you would figure out the, you know, to." He basically gave me a VOR exercise. He said, "You know, use the VOR to figure out what is the course to such and such VOR, the Kennebunk VOR," and I pretty much knew how to do that. You know, so I basically tuned the VOR to the right frequency and then used the VOR head there. I forget what it's called, but to tune to center the needle, and centering the needle showed me the heading. So that was good. I forgot to ID the VOR once I tuned it in. That was a mistake. But we did that. And then he says, you could also do it. And he's pointing to my iPad. And he says, you could also do this there. All right. And so we started to play around a little bit with the iPad. And I'm starting to go, wait a minute. Oh, I don't know how that works. I you know, I sort of understand that it should do that, but I don't know how. And there's just a lot going on in that 4Flight. I get that 4Flight is the Cadillac of these nav things, but I'm, you know, even, you know, it's becoming more and more apparent to me why that is or how that is.
It's an electronic flight bag.
Yeah, but it's, yeah.
It's not a, more, yeah, it's more not, than it's not that. A nav thing. It's an electronic flight bag.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It I was a little surprised when I I've been using the logbook part of it to kind of just for the fun. I mean, I'm also keeping my regular logbook, but I've been kind of creating an electronic logbook in ForeFlight. Having actually used my iPad during the flight, it had all kinds of suggestions about how long the flight was, and it actually tracked it. I had not knowingly turned on flight tracking in ForeFlight. And as I was kind of closing things up, it said, we've saved this, we've cracked your flight. Would you like to do that every time? And I said, sure, why not? And then dug into it a little bit and discovered, hey, look, there's my trip. All the turns, all the climbs, all the descents, everything's right there. One of the things I struggled with a little bit, and I think I've figured it out since then, but was to use the ForeFlight to determine how far I am from a given destination. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm really bad at estimating distances when I'm in flight. It's like 10 miles to the east, 5 miles. Am I 5 miles or am I 10 miles? Or am I, what am I?
All well, right. We can hold our thumb and our forefinger a couple of inches apart, and men think that that's 12 inches.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if that's exactly my problem, but yes, I get your point. Okay. And I'm thinking, the iPad and there's ForeFlight knows that I'm headed to Biddeford. It must somewhere here tell me how far away I am from Biddeford. I didn't want to get too distracted from flying the airplane, but I think I found that indication after I landed, and I'll be able to use that in the future. Anyways, so a lot of stuff going on there, and I can easily imagine IFR pilots. Well, so I always assumed that this was just another tool that IFR pilots had for during flight for tracking and doing whatnot. My CFI is telling me that yes, but that you can't just use an off-the-shelf iPad as a, and I don't know the exact terminology here, but as an official IFR instrument, all right, that the iPad has to be somehow certified. The individual iPad has to be somehow certified. And that, in fact, Sporty's will do this to you. You can send your iPad to Sporty's. And for some price, he says, like $800, you can get your iPad certified. And they'll send you back your iPad with a certificate and everything like that. And suddenly it becomes... Do you know what I'm talking about? Does this make sense?
Suddenly it becomes what?
Becomes a legitimate instrument for IFR flight in your cockpit, I guess. That's the best I can say it.
I got to check into that.
Yeah, I got to check into that also. I think there's, if you start peeling the onion here a little bit, there are three different levels of electronic flight bag recognized by the FAA. Level one is just a basic EFB, let's say ForeFlight without GPS, okay, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Where you've got charting, you've got other aeronautical information, but you may not have track guidance, you may not have position finding, etc. And then you get into class two, which starts to add things back. Class three is something that's basically hardwired to the airplane and becomes, depending on how it's configured and installed, I think it becomes part of the aircraft operating environment or part of the required equipment on the airplane.
Yeah, that's a class three.
Yeah. But... your note here about using iPad for approaches. Sure you can once.
Yeah. Well, there's that. Yeah. And of course, and I would imagine that it's always acceptable to use it as an advisory instrument,
That's exactly what it is.
Confirmation for your more conventional IFR instruments.
But in a declared emergency,
you can use anything you want.
Right.
And that's a deliberate,
sure,
a declared emergency.
Yeah.
You can't use it and get on the ground and say, oh, it was an emergency. Sorry, guys. That you can use anything you want to, anything that works if it gets you down on the ground alive and intact.
totally makes sense. I guess the implication of what my conversation with my CFI was that there are situations where you can use ForeFlight on your iPad as a primary instrument for instrument flight, but only if it's been certified. I'm making
finger
quotes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Finger quotes.
I'm behind on that because I wasn't aware Sporty's had a way to certify.
That's what he said, and I haven't actually looked it up.
It's $895.
There you go.
Okay, according to Sporty's website. And it's not at all clear to me. Here we go. Sporty's easy approval is for second-generation iPads and newer, including the iPad Mini, utilizing ForeFlight Mobile. Approvals are for Class 1 EFB authorization with Type A and B applications. This gets into commercial operations. For Part 91, you don't need this.
Okay. For
that's,
commercial.
That's, I think, the big difference.
Yeah, that makes
sense. Part 91, subpart F, also fractional, or 135, 121.
Mm-hmm.
121, probably you actually need something more. You could still use it for advisory purposes. I don't know. It depends on the 121 op specs. But, there's a whole page here. Let me zap it to you about all this.
Well, I've got a question back here on the RoboPilot thing.
Yeah.
If the autopilot and RoboPilot take turns flying the airplane, which one gets to log the PIC?
There you go.
That's
the sole manipulator of the controls includes the autopilot disconnect switch.
There you go.
All right. End of after show.